and welcome to the Locust Roundtable podcast. Today we're talking with two East Coasters. We've got Liz Hand calling in from Maine and Jeffrey Ford in New Jersey, and both of whom have written science fiction and fantasy and won lots of awards at both novel and short story length. So welcome to you both.
Hello, how you doing, Karen?
Doing very well,
Liz.
Thanks.
Yeah, hey, delighted to be here.
And so I know that both of you have just recently wrapped up your academic semesters, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the kind of teaching that you do.
Jeff, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I teach at a community college. I teach literature and I teach writing. I teach a fiction writing class. I'm happy as hell that the semester's over, I have to tell you. I mean, I've been doing this for about, I don't know, over 25 years at this place, 23, I think. And so, you know, it's getting long in the tooth. But I enjoy the teaching. I mean, it's fun. And I'm happy for the summer. It's kind of stuff I've been doing mostly, I guess, in the fiction writing realm, which most of your listeners would be more interested in. It's a community college class, so I have all different ranges of students and all different ages, all different demographic backgrounds. I get a huge, you know, swath of different types of writing. It's not just a class for speculative fiction or fantasy fiction or science fiction. It's everything you could think of. And some of the students are really good, and some of them get really good and go on to different places like where Liz teaches, or at Goddard, or the New School. We have some articulation agreements with a couple of these, schools beyond. We have a pretty strong creative writing department for a community college, which I think is fairly unusual. As far as the teaching of fiction goes, I don't do a lot of lecturing about what, you know, a story is, what I expect to see. I like to have them write and then let's see what they come up with. I mean, by this time in your life, 17, 18, 19, all the way up to 90, I mean, you know what a story is and how to tell it. So let's see what you come up with. And then I have them read the stories out loud. Every story must be read out loud. I can't tell you why, but there's something really good about people reading their own work in a setting where other people are really listening and thinking critically about it. I find that to be a huge help. I don't do a lot of marking up of papers until students have revised the work, a number of times just from our discussions about it. And then from there, they, you know, sometimes they'll revise them, sometimes they'll drop them and start something else. And we've had some good success with it. I've had some good success with it through the semesters. I've been doing this for about, I don't know, maybe 15 years, 10, 15 years. What about you, Liz?
Wow, that's a long time. And how many days a week do you have to actually go in and do that? Like a couple times a week, every day?
No, I mean, I only do this. I run the class on Thursday night. It's at 7 o'clock. It's a three-hour class. We usually go through about, like, I don't know, maybe 50 to 70 pages of work a night. I always get out of there late. And
wow,
the people always have work. And I'm going to tell you something now that's probably going to get me in trouble. But I tell them the first day, everybody in the class gets an A. That's it. No matter what happens, you get an A in the class. All right, let's write some fiction. And then they get into it. There's nothing hanging over their head. They're not worried about the grade. They write. They write a lot. I mean, I really get a great response. But, I mean, grades are kind of pointless to me when you're talking about fiction writing.
Yeah.
I mean, you could get a good grade in it, but that doesn't mean a damn thing when you go out in the world and you're trying to publish fiction or you're trying to become a writer.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, I take it off the table early on, which, you know, I could see there'd be some contention about that, and some of my colleagues would probably not be too happy with that. But, I mean, that's basically what I do.
Well, and I think if you want people to write, I think that's a great way of doing it. I'm on the faculty at the Stone Coast MFA program in creative writing, which is a low residency program. So I don't actually go. I go twice a year in January and July, along with the other faculty and students. And during a 10-day period, everybody is actually in sort of a university or, you know, a setting, a school setting where everybody is together and you have workshops and classes and things like that. But for the rest of the time, I'm mentoring 5 grad students a semester. And once a month getting packets that have either, you know, novel in progress or short fiction, whatever they're, or for those who are working on a nonfiction paper, which is a requirement for the degree, I'll be, you know, working with them on that. So, but I think the whole, what you were saying about grades is absolutely the way to go. I mean, for the grad students, you know, you're not giving people an A or a B or a C. It's basically, you know, you're getting your degree or you're not getting your degree. So you're doing the work, yeah. You're doing the work. But I think for undergraduates to basically uphold them to the same standard, which is basically you're going to write this or you're not going to write it, you know, and you're going to be committed to it or you're not. And it's not, you know, what you do is not dependent on, you know,
reward.
Yeah, a reward. Like, yeah, right. The way that the writing world, the publishing world works too, right, Jeff? You know, the big rewards that, that are out there fucking all the time.
Yeah, you know? I never got the A though.
Yeah. You know, I mean, what would that be? The MacArthur, you know, getting a MacArthur grant?
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, I think taking that off the table right at the beginning is brilliant. And I wish that more, and maybe more of them, you know, maybe other people do. I think that all writing programs should kind of work like that so that people are focused on actually doing the work and sharing it. And reading it out loud is enough. I think that's another great thing to do. I did a couple of weeks ago, I did a day of workshops here in Maine at three different middle schools. And so it was 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. And this is in, you know, kind of rural Maine. Or yes, it is in rural Maine, pretty rural. But what they were, it's an arts program, and every year they have Authors Day, and they bring in for the school, they bring in a writer to do with the lower grades, they have a writer for the middle grades, and then they have a writer for the you know, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, the middle school. So I got the middle school kids, and this year's theme was poetry. And so since I just finished doing this book, this young adult book on Arthur Rimbaud, I thought, well, I'm going to talk about Rimbaud because he was a kid, you know, he was like this 15-year-old writing these poems. And so I went in and did this little presentation and had the kids read a brief poem by Rimbaud and then gave them like 10 or 15 minutes to write a poem themselves. And everybody had to write a poem. And,
hey, when you were doing that book, did you read Henry Miller's book on
Rimbaud? Oh, yeah, yeah, The Time of the Assassin. Oh, yeah, I read all of that stuff. But these kids got so into it, and the teachers, I could see kind of going in, they were all a little nervous because middle school kids and poetry, you know. Anyway, it was fantastic. They got totally into it because I said, all right, we're going to do a poetry slam, and none of these kids had ever heard of a poetry slam. And when they started out, they were all shy. Nobody wanted to stand up and read their poems. But I said, you know, you got to do this. And they did, and they all got totally into it. And they were all, some of them were saying, well, wait, can I write a second poem to read out loud? And I think it's very, I think it's, you know, I hate to, you know, go into like kind of psychobabble, but it is, I think it's very validating to hear your work read out loud. You know,
yeah, but it's also good to you can catch things that between you and the paper seem good, but when you hear them actually, and I've had this happen to me a lot of times while reading stuff, you know, you hear them and they either sound tinny or they sound or something sounds better than you thought it was going to sound, or you know, it's a different way of accessing the material of seeing the material or hearing it. So in that way, I think it's good too.
Yeah, I find that when I'm reading my, as I'm sure you probably do too, when I'm reading my own work, and I've learned now to keep a pen or a pencil in hand if I'm at a place like ReaderCon or something where I can get away with that, and because I'll note exactly what you're saying. I'll be reading something and I'll be like, well, God, that's totally clunky, and try to, you know, strike it from the text, so I'll remember to go back and take it out of there, which is a little harder to do if a book has already been published. Do you, Jeff, do you read your stuff Like if you're writing on a story.
I read like out loud to myself, like whisper it. I whisper it to myself. Yeah, I read it out loud. Yeah.
do you read like the whole thing out loud? Like do you finish?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm writing a book, I don't read the whole thing, but whatever piece I'm working on at that time or a story, I'll start from the beginning when I start and I'll read through it out loud and I'll make changes in it until I get to the point where I left off the day before and then I'll just start again, you know, but reading it, it helps me, you know?
Yeah. I don't read the whole thing out loud, but I'll read portions of it out loud. But then I always think, oh, I should probably go back and just do this from the beginning to the end. But I'm just too embarrassed at the thought of, you know, standing there in my or sitting there in my office and reading the whole thing out loud to myself.
Yeah, I try to keep it low so nobody hears me because they'll break my chops.
There's a question I wanted to ask you, don't kill me or laugh at me because I'm serious. Because the one question that everybody always asks of a writer is always, where do you get your ideas? And for most writers, I actually don't care. Even if you're a great writer, I don't really care all that much where you get your ideas from. But every time I read something by you, I'm always like, where the fuck did that come from? Where the hell did that come from? Where did, I mean, really and truly, I mean that in a good way, to me, it seems like your work as a reader, to me, it seems as though your work accesses sort of a dream state more than other writers.
Well,
is that the case? I was just curious.
Yeah, I mean, when I'm in the middle of writing one of these things, I mean, it's really kind of like you're in another place. I mean, I can see it really clearly when it's going well, and it's like a dream. I mean, this is one of the things that interested me about, when I was working with John Gardner. I mean, he said about fiction, it's what you're trying to achieve is a vivid and continuous dream,
Yeah, right. That might.
But the thing that really interests me about that is that when you think about dreams, the stuff that happens in them is outlandish, but you completely believe it. So it's like that's the trick, I think, in fiction writing is how to write what you want to write, but to make it believable while it's going on, like as it is in the dream state. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you can have some crazy stuff happen in a dream and wake up like your heart pounding and stuff. But in reality, when you're awake, like this shit could never happen, But in the dream state, you're completely invested in it and you believe it. Like, how do you make that happen with fiction? I think that's one of the secrets, So I don't know. I'm not sure how it works, but that's one thing I think that I definitely have had that experience with it. But I use dreams a lot, and I just look for unusual little things. My ears are always open. And when I meet people, I meet people in the grocery store or whatever, and they may say something, like just a little thing. But then it's like that's when you start pumping them for continue the conversation. Where's this going? What do you have to tell me?
Say that. Remember Stan Mack's Real Life Funnies? He used to run in the Village Voice.
What was that? No, I don't remember it.
Oh, it was a series. He was a cartoonist, kind of like Jules Pfeiffer, but he would, every week in the Village Voice, he would have like four or six panels that he would illustrate. And all it was like some little overheard bit of conversation. You always wanted to see what happened before or after, but all you ever had were those six panels.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. I'm always open to that. I'm always listening for that. And then, I have certain places I read online and in the news and all that. And you can use that stuff all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, there's great places online. I mean, there's this paranormal site I check out every day. They have new stories of the paranormal, which are really, a lot of it's, most of it is all, it's bullshit. But it's great story ideas. It's like the Breakfast of Champions, for a fantasy writer. It's like, what was I looking at the other day? There was a thing about in physics where they discovered that the future can affect the past. Did you read about this?
No. I don't think so.
Yeah, the future can seeps back into the past and can affect it. I mean, this is something that's supposedly proven with physics now. I mean, what a great idea for a story in some way. I haven't come up with one, but I mean, it would be a great idea. But I check out all these wacky sites and I get all kinds of crazy ideas from them. And then you, you know, try to make them as believable as possible.
I have to check that one out. I hadn't heard that.
Oh, I got a whole list of places I go.
Wow.
Most of it comes to nothing, but, you know, it's fun to read it, too.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and it also makes it look like you're working when you're just reading stuff online.
All right, so now you get the question, like, where do your ideas come from?
Where do my ideas come from?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, probably mostly from landscapes.
Mood?
I'm sorry?
Do you start with a mood?
Well, not necessarily a mood. Sometimes it'll just be a place, you know, like I'll see some place and it will affect me.
Yeah.
And then the people sort of appear afterwards to occupy it. There's this great line that from Robert Bloch talking about Norman Bates and Psycho, I read years ago, and he said, referring to Norman Bates, he said, "Keep the man on haunted ground and he'll haunt." Which is something I've used, you know, I've told people over the years and told students, but I really kind of feel that way, that I find certain landscapes that just sort of preoccupy me, and I end up writing about them. And sometimes it can take a long time before I'll go back and do it. But also, yep. Just people, like, you know, sometimes it's just like what you were talking about. They'll just be sort of oddball people, eccentric people who I know or who I meet. And I'll just feel like, you know, this person actually deserves a story of his or her own. And so I'll give it to them. But yeah. I'm not really good at making stuff up. So I, like you were saying, keeping your ears open. I think I'm always sort of keeping my eyes open and ears open, you know, looking for people to kind of cast.
Do you like to do research on stuff? You seem to like that.
I do. I love it. I love doing research.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a, you know, in another life I would have been some kind of a professor of something or other. I'm not. But I would have loved to have been able to, just spend my life in that ivory tower, I don't know, or an archaeologist up there doing digs or something. Kind of boring, repetitive stuff, but learning a lot about one thing.
Yeah, I remember the first, when I first did a research for a book, I was dreading it. Like, oh man, this is like fucking homework, you know? And then when I started to get into it, it became really fascinating. I like it in a lot of ways. And it, not only that, but it opens up the possibility of the story in ways that you couldn't possibly imagine before. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. With that girl in the glass?
Yeah, the girl in the glass, definitely, yeah. With that. And Mrs. Sharbook. I mean, you have a certain idea of how it's going to go. But then when you read something about the time period, it takes it in another direction that you weren't aware of. And I like that kind of extemporaneous, you know, it just, you know, this idea comes up out of your research and you can take off in that direction, which it makes it kind of fresh in a way, you know?
Yeah, you can find these oddball things. You learn these things and you're like, wow, wait a minute. I never knew that. Has anybody ever written about that? Now you can Google and find out if somebody has. But just make use of, you know, these kind of weird fun facts that you come across.
If you set your finger down on any place in time and scratch the surface just a little bit below what the, you know, the bull that they tell you in high school about history and stuff, you find this, you know, incredible stories and stuff like that that you had no idea existed. I just read the other day, this is just something I read the other day, that did you know that the Japanese actually invaded a place in the U.S. during the Second World War?
No. Where did they
There are two islands in the Aleutians that the Japanese took. during the Second World War. I had no idea about that. It's kind of interesting, you know? Just stuff like that.
Yeah, really?
Not like I'm going to do anything with it, but it just fascinates me.
Yeah, no, if there's one thing I've noticed it's in doing these podcasts with so many of the writers that are my all-time favorites, it seems like that eclectic openness to just any new information seems kind of ubiquitous, and I think it's one of the things that seems to bind the community together a little bit.
Well, I think writers are eccentric, a lot of us, by nature, and I think we're drawn to other eccentrics, and I think writers are also sort of obsessive, and obsessives are often collectors, and so I think, you know, we're out there looking for all this weird stuff, and we're collecting it, not necessarily to put on our, you know, kitchen shelves, but we put this stuff into our books and our stories.
Well, and with both of you, I've noticed that, for instance, you bring the same feel to the science fiction that you write as you do to the fantasy that you write. I think a lot of people tend to think that, oh, there's this hard divide and science fiction is written this way and fantasy is written that way. And I don't see that with you guys, but one of the things I really like is that I think sometimes some people can get turned off by the kind of hard edges of science fiction, but when it's written with the style that you do, I think sometimes that can make it more accessible.
Well, you know, there's a problem with that, though. I mean, I think my approach is fairly eclectic. I mean, different types of stories and everything, you know, science fiction, more realistic stuff or whatever. It makes it difficult for people to figure out who you are and where to find you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that that's a problem in the actual sale of a lot of the stuff, you know, that I've put out, or people to find it and stuff. I mean, Mrs. Shaw Book was shelved in the horror section, mystery section, science fiction and fantasy section, and mainstream sections of different bookstores. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So, yeah, it's good for the writing, but it may not be the best marketing idea.
Yeah, I have had the exact same thing happen. Yeah, and it's, I think in a way it's good now that we're moving away from the, for people like us, moving away from the brick and mortar model, because I constantly throughout my career heard say, well, we don't know where to put your books, you know, on the shelves, or people going into a store, well, I don't know where to find your books on the shelves. Whereas, you know, with more online publishing and more online sales of books, you don't have that problem. You know, you go there and you look for Jeffrey Ford on Amazon and all of your books are there in one place.
Yeah.
So, I think that's a good thing. I mean, I'm hoping that's a good thing. And I think, you know, I think as writers, I mean, as somebody who reads your work, somebody who's a fan of Jeff's work, I think they're going to read everything that you've written. Don't you think?
Well, don't maybe. I mean, maybe. There's, I don't know how many of them there are out there, but but maybe. But one of the things that surprises me a lot of times is what Karen was talking about, this kind of eclectic nature. And one of the things I've noticed in the field of SF, fantasy, horror, I mean, seriously, the people in this field, the writers, are really some of the smartest people I ever met and have the most divergent interests. But a lot of times, also in the field, you have this sense of like the eclectic nature of things kind of gets lost, and it's like, well, you know, people are looking for or writing only a certain kind of book or only this, and I know that has to do with the business end of it, but there are people who appreciate the restrictions more than the openness. I feel anyway.
Yeah, you mean they want to, you know. They want to know that they're getting a science fiction book.
Exactly. I mean, how many times has Strain put out like Eclipse, one of the Eclipse volumes, which is, you know, fantasy and science fiction, and the first thing that people say is, well, there's hardly any science fiction in here. You know what I mean? Oh, there's not enough fantasy in here.
This is a really good story, but I don't think it's fantastic at all. It's just mainstream. It's just a really good story.
Right, exactly. It's, you know, I'm disappointed because this story is so great by Karen Joy Fowler, you know, the Pelican Bar. What a disappointment, you know what I mean? It should have had more, the alien should have been more alien-y in it, you know? something like that. So I don't know. I don't get that head, but.
Yeah, no, I think it can be problematical, but I don't know. I guess I feel like if people, you know, what you're just saying about Karen Joy Fowler stuff, if people are going to judge a story on its merits, the first thing should be whether or not it's any good. And then whether it's fantasy or science fiction or, you know, a mystery or a thriller, all of those are just marketing terms. And unfortunately, we have to live with them. But I would be very happy to just do away with that completely. Just have to throw everything on the shelf and call it fiction.
Well, Liz, let me ask you this. Do you ever set out when you have a before you start writing a work, you don't start out and say, I'm going to write me a science fiction this time.
Yes, by God.
And then come up with the idea. You come up with the idea, whatever it is, you write it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And some, you know, sometimes certain stories, I don't know what they are. You know, certain stories that I'm not sure. I'm like, is this a fantasy story? Is this science fiction? People will ask me. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. That's not really what I'm concerned about, you know. And I think there's a certain literal mindedness in readers that's probably just something that people are, you know, we're evolved to look for resolutions and things. And that readers want to, you know, they don't want to have that uncertainty bundled into something that they're reading. They want to, you know, they want to understand what they're reading. They want it to all make sense at the end. They want to know if they're starting out with something that's, you know, they think is a science fiction story, that it's going to end as one.
Well, you can't blame them. I mean, that's what they like. You like what you like, you know. But right. It does. I've grown used to it over the years. That's basically, you know, a large part of the readership. But you know, what can you say? People read because they want to read something that they're going to enjoy a lot, you know. Or so what the hell? What can you do?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, sometimes as a reviewer, I feel like it's so easy to let your mind go down that genre classification path first. Like, it's so easy to start going through Eclipse 4 and go, oh, well, this is, you know, horror, and this, you know, what was it, one of the things I said in my review of it? The story, it's an odd anthology when the stories that deal with dead people are not the horror stories.
That's a good line.
But again, I you know, it's falling back into a kind of mental rut, because it's the, I don't know, it almost feels like it's the obvious question to ask, it's the easy question to ask, and sometimes, you know, it's easy to kind of skip along the surface that way, and you get your word count, and at least you've told people a little bit what to expect. But yeah, sometimes I feel like I'm being lazy when I do that.
Well, it's, you know, it seems to me in recent years that the science fiction and fantasy are drawing back to the center, you know, from where they had been in like the 90s and so forth. There was a lot of like, you know, writers who were, you know, slipstream, whatever you want to call it. But it seems to be drawing back to the center. But horror seems to be doing what science fiction and fantasy were doing in the 90s and opening up in all kinds of different interesting directions now, to me anyway. Personally, I don't know if anybody else sees that.
Yeah, and there's also some interesting writers out there, like Chris Adrian, who just had a book come out. I forget what it's called, but it's a riff on A Midsummer Night's Dream. And he had a novel that came out a few years ago called The Children's Hospital.
Yeah.
Which is very strange. Did you read that?
I didn't read it. The idea for it actually was something I had actually had before. And it's even online somewhere. I wrote about it in something. But, you know, where this hospital gets, I think what happens is it gets knocked off its moorings and it's like floating around, right?
Well, yeah, and it's a flood. There's like a flood. It's the only thing left in the world that we're.
Yeah, I didn't read that. I read some of his stories in his book of short stories that came out in between these two books. And they were interesting. They were pretty interesting stories.
But that was a novel, The Children's Hospital, which felt like a horror novel. It was one of these things that, you know, you're given it to review and it's a quote unquote mainstream novel, but really what it is, you know, it's an apocalyptic, is it a science fiction novel? Well, it kind of was, but what it really felt like ultimately was like a horror novel. And if it had been marketed as a horror novel, I have no idea how it did commercially, if it was a big success or not, but it would have been interesting to see the horror readership, what they might have thought of it, because I think a lot of people might have picked up on it if it had been marketed that way. It was a cool book. It was an interesting novel.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, as I see Gary Wolf's online, and of course I've been reading Evaporating Genres right now, and part of me is like, you know, we could just add him to the call.
Throw him in. I'm cool with it.
In, Gary.
Okay, let me see if I can get him. Are we going to get him?
There he is.
Hey, Gary. It's Karen and Jeff Ford and Liz Hand.
And Liz. We're all here.
Hey, guys. How are you?
What's up?
How's it going?
So we were talking, and I saw you come online, and then all of a sudden we're talking about how genres are filtering through and evaporating, and I went, you know, Gary's online.
Cool. Well, I was trying to figure out who was calling me, because, let me see. I didn't get your message, I guess. Did you type something? Or
No, I just hit call.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool.
We've Shanghai'd you, Gary.
I've been Shanghai'd again.
But yeah, so we were talking about, you know, that sometimes people are looking for, they're looking for a queer cut genre, but of course some of the most interesting stories just don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pointing out that sometimes I feel like as a reviewer it's so easy to start looking at a story through various genre lenses. It feels, I don't know, almost like a crutch sometimes.
Well, I see people do that all the time. I mean, the latest thing that people are doing is reading Heart of Darkness as a horror story. And the book's pretty well. But, you know, I don't think he would have sold it to Weird Tales.
It could have very easily been sold to Weird Tales. I always read that as a horror story. I'm not kidding either. I think it was in some anthology. Maybe in the 60s is a horror novel.
Well, at the end, the guy's talking about his wife, right?
Yeah.
Because she says, what was the last, doesn't she say to him, what was the last thing he mentioned? And he says he asked about you, or he spoke about you, and the last thing the guy says is the horror.
The horror.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, that's true. I mean, that's
why he splits.
Most literal. Yeah. There was an anthology. Speaking of anthologies,
just
there
kidding.
Was a horror. But it wouldn't surprise me for that to show up in a horror anthology, because if you go back before the horror boom as a pop genre and look at anthologies in the 30s and 40s, like that one from Random House, Great Tales of Terror and the Supernatural, there were all kinds of things. And I've seen Rose for Emily anthologized as a horror story.
Yeah, that's kind of the anthology, I think. And I mean, I think I'm reading a great book now, a nonfiction book called Electric Eden by Rob Young, who's a writer in the UK who writes about music. He's the editor of a site called The Wire. Anyway, this book, the subtitle is Unearthing Britain's Visionary Music. And what's fascinating about it is it's not just about music, a quote-unquote folk music in Great Britain, but reading he goes back to like the Symbolists and William Morris and Arthur Machen and H.G. Wells. He takes all of this stuff, all of these artists, and kind of throws them into the mix and shows how they were all influencing each other. A composer in the early 20th century, whose name now escapes me, who was actually doing musical settings of Arthur Machen. Who I had no idea. The Great God Pan and stuff like that.
I did read about that.
It's a fantastic book.
Yeah, he was a well-known composer.
Yeah, he was. He just was well-known to me. But he was somebody who was a contemporary of Ray Vaughan Williams. And I'm thinking, you know, like now, today, how many contemporary early 21st century composers are, you know, doing settings of Jeff Ford's work, or China Meables, or something.
Actually, there was a guy in Alaska who was doing something with, was it the Physiognomy?
Really?
Some guy, composer in Alaska. Yeah, but I lost track of him. He would communicate with me for a couple of years. He taught at some school up there, but he was a composer.
Fantastic.
I never heard anything more about it.
Yeah, that was great.
But, you know, you could think about it yourself, what, you know, as far as music influencing your own work. I remember when I was writing and I just started listening to jazz. I hadn't listened to it much before. It was always like when I was younger, it was like, you know, rock and roll and stuff. But it took me a while to get it. You know what I mean? To get what it was about. But when it did, I felt like it opened my writing up somewhat, too, you know, in a way. Do you have stuff like that where it, you know, it influences you? I feel like that like music influences me that way.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, no, I had the same thing. I didn't really start listening to jazz more seriously until maybe the last 5 or 6 years. It was one of those things that, I listened to and I liked it as kind of background music, but it's only really been in the last few years that I've been listening to, you know, Bill Evans and Miles Davis and John Coltrane, listening to, you know, like you, not just listening to rock and roll.
Yeah, I can't listen to it when I'm writing, but I get a feel, you know, a feeling of, you know, the way one thing works off another, or one thing builds from another, and it can take you a place that is still within the story, but like somewhat outside of it too, you know, and then loops back into the story, and you know, that kind of sense of jazz like that, I really like. But I'm still working on like appreciating it, because I've only gotten up as far as like Lester Young. I got a ways to go.
It's funny you mentioned Lester Young, because I know one of the things that's hard, it's hard to articulate. But the way music influences, there's a wonderful story by Peter Straub called Pork Pie Hat.
Pork Pie Hat, I love
it. Yeah,
that.
I know, I love it. It's a great story.
And he showed me once. Actually, I went out and bought this VHS tape. There was a mid-1950s TV show called Omnibus. And there was a performance of Lester Young's. Actually, it was Billie Holiday was singing a song, and Lester Young, who was an older guy at that point, looking like he was half asleep, stood up and did an absolutely, heavenly solo for about maybe a minute, maybe 90 seconds. And that solo was the origin of that story. Now, to make a connection between anything in that song and the story is pointless. But you can see how that musical feeling informs the character in the story.
Yeah, yes. His music, especially when Teddy Wilson is his piano player, when he plays with him, and you know, when Billie Holiday sings or something like that, it goes into different places where you wouldn't expect it, but it always seems like to be part of the same story in a way, the songs.
Yeah, and sometimes you hear musicians talk about structuring their solos as a story. I mean, you're trying to get in and out in 1 or 2 minutes, and you have to have a beginning, middle, and end. And the thing that amazes me about jazz musicians is that they made this up all the time. I mean, if they play a sequence of 17 notes that you heard back in 1942, they're going to hear about it, because fans are nuts.
Yeah. Well, plus the fact of improvisation. I mean, when I sit down to write a story, a lot of times I don't know where it's going. You know, I it builds itself as it goes, in a way. You know, it opens up in front of me as it goes, and it's really kind of improvisation. You start with a couple of notes and you build on it. You know, and I don't know.
That's a good way of putting it, though.
I'm sorry.
I thought that was a good way of putting it. That makes me feel a little bit relieved as a reader of both of your stories. Sometimes I'm thinking, I have no idea where this is going.
Yeah, that makes two of us.
But that's one of the best feelings I can get from a story. The last thing I want to do is pick up a story and say, I know exactly where this is going.
Actually, what? Yeah, I've noticed that the longer I've been reading, the more when I get that feeling of, wow, I have no idea where this is going to wind up, the more I really appreciate it. And sometimes if a story ends up resolving in a familiar pattern, I'm like, oh, was that it? Oh, that's a shame.
It's much better to not know where a story is going. My feeling is always that if I don't know where something is going, the reader's not going to know either. So and obviously I'll rewrite something so that it all resolves. Ideally it will resolve. But
oh, yeah.
But I think readers want to be surprised. I think they want to have trust in you. They want to have confidence in a writer, but they don't want to know what's going to happen. Although
the reader can't be surprised unless you, as the writer, are surprised.
Are surprised.
You know?
Exactly. I did read once, as far as mysteries go, that the reader always has to feel that that for mysteries to work, or the most successful ones for readers, are the ones where readers always feel like they're one step ahead, whether they are or not, that they feel that they're figuring out what's going on. So anyway, I thought that was kind of an interesting observation. And then I guess ideally at the end, you turn it upside down so they don't know what was going on.
You know, when I was out in Seattle recently, I saw Ted Chiang, and I was running this idea by him, and he wasn't going for it at all. And I can see it in his stories. There's a lot of writers who could really be successful with a lot of planning. You know, he's one of them, I think. And because he was kind of he wasn't poo-pooing it, but he said for him it was completely different. He plans a lot, you know.
Yeah.
But also Poe, I think, is like this. He's a very shrewd writer. I mean, it's like, you know, he's thought about these things before you've gotten to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think you can be successful in a lot of different ways. But the opposite of that way is, you know, I could see these writers are very successful with what they do. So, you know, I guess there's a lot of different ways to approach it.
Well, I think there seems to be a tension among the reader communities of the ones we were talking about earlier, who really want us, you know, they want to know that a science fiction story is like this and a fantasy story is like that, and they want the neat little boxes. And then there are the readers who have gotten more adventurous for whatever reasons, and who particularly don't want to know exactly how a story's going to end just because they have read the first three paragraphs.
Well,
go ahead. I'm sorry, Liz.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think you can, you know, I think there's plenty of room for all, you know, for different approaches. I mean, I get a different buzz from reading one of Ted's stories than I do from one of Jeff's, but I can, you know, find them both superbly well done but for different reasons. I mean, Ted's work reads very much as though it's very carefully constructed.
Yeah.
You know, and which is great. I mean, I wish I could do that. And when I read Jeff's work, it does, as we were saying earlier, it does have this beautiful dreamlike quality, but it resolves. You know?
Are you saying it's a fucking mess?
No, it's not a fucking mess. No,
because it resolves.
It does resolve, you know. You're able to, I mean, and I think part of it is probably our brains are, you know, our brains are wired to impose narrative on everything. I mean, when we're asleep, you know, you hear a noise when you're dreaming, and there's some noise that happens out in the street, and your brain is already converting that into part of the dream narrative.
Yeah.
You know, light is shining in your room, and in your dream, you know, you're interpreting that as a fire or whatever. And I think, and with your work, Jeff, I can see that, you know, you probably have, your brain is probably really, it's probably really well equipped to take all of this kind of raw material and impose a narrative on it so that it does make sense.
One of the phrases that entered the critical discourse a few decades ago, which is very useful, is dream logic. Because and the reason I think it's useful is because at the end of the story, it feels like logic. But when you're reading the transitions and the sudden left turns, it feels like you're completely disoriented, which is what happens with a dream. I don't know what the latest in dream research is, but the last time I read is that the dream is really reconstructed as you're waking up and putting the pieces together. The narrative is not necessarily there while you're asleep, while you're in, REM sleep.
I remember the term that Nick Gevers used to use all the time was oneric.
Oneric.
And the first time, the first time I ever saw it, I thought he was talking about the guy from the Bible, Onan, masturbates. You know, I was like, what?
Onanistic fiction. That's a different one.
I had to look that up. Karen, you were talking about Gary's book. I'm not talking about the most recent one, but the one before that. I was reading that essay. I had written to Gary about this, but the essay at the back, and it's talking. He was talking about the kind of thing he and Amelia did this paper at ReaderCon. He's talking about exactly the kind of thing you were talking about in the genre, where I think in the 50s they took the New Yorker and looked at who published in the New Yorker, and there are a lot of genre writers really in there.
There were. or people who are not people writing in genre who didn't think of themselves as genre writers. John Cheever wrote some wonderful fantasy stories early in his career.
Yeah.
And I looked at this biography of Cheever, and one of the, when he was an old, bitter, dying man, and he was complaining to somebody about how he'd been trapped in writing suburban alcoholic realism, and nobody remembered the great fantasy stories he used to write.
Well, The Enormous Radio is actually, you know, that's a fantasy, right? With with suburban drunks in it. But I think that I thought that was an interesting essay because it shows that there was this kind of interruption in the field where, you know, things became really codified after that time, around that time period. I guess it's still like that now.
It wasn't just the field; it became really codified in the, you know, within the quote unquote mainstream places. Yeah. Like the Atlantic Monthly and Harper's and the New Yorker, which would publish stories that were, you know, John Collier or John Cheever or whoever.
Shirley Jackson.
Exactly. Yeah. That did have a fantastical element. And, I mean, you get a little bit of that now, I think, in The New Yorker. Occasionally you'll get a story with a fantastical element. But if it's not, you know, it's relatively rare to see that happening if it's not by a big name.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that just to give credit where it's due, I kind of stole that idea from Michael Chabon when he was doing one of the McSweeney's anthologies. And he was, I think he said that the American short story was kidnapped by the diurnal moment of truth, moment of recognition. And I went back and looked at all a lot of stories in New York from the late 40s to the mid-50s. And if I were going to put a date on it, I would say that you could almost say the American short story was kidnapped the day a perfect day for Banana Fish appeared in the New Yorker.
Huh.
Because after that, people were doing Salinger stories for the next 10 years.
Right.
Well, then it became Raymond Carver, and everybody did those stories for the
and
next
Ann
10 years.
Yeah, and Beatty.
Not that I have anything against them. I like all those writers, but,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But I was reading The New Yorker as a kid, and I remember when Donald Barthelme showed up, I thought, wow, they're waking up. They're doing something different now.
Well, Sylvia Townsend Warner, all those stories from Kingdoms of Elfin.
Absolutely.
They were all published in The New Yorker.
So there was, you know, so what I think is happening with this whole tradition of fantasy is kind of, you know, re-emerging. The one thing I found that people misunderstood about that title, Evaporating Genres, because I think Jim Kelly or somebody retranslated it as disappearing. The whole point is that they're not disappearing. The whole point is evaporation means that the material is there. It's in the atmosphere. It's part of the way, it's part of the culture we breathe now. And yeah. I think fantasy and to some extent even science fiction is entering that. Now, I think science fiction has more barriers to it than fantasy does.
Well, science fiction's, I think, harder to write good science fiction. I mean, I was saying this to somebody the other day, but it's to get the, what you really need, I think, for a good science fiction story is the state of the character is in some way resonant with the technology or the scientific aspect of the story. And or there's some kind of metaphorical connection between them. And that's difficult to affect. And that does, in a way, take planning, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it takes planning, and it also, you have to actually know about something.
Yeah. That's what leaves me out of it.
At some level, you do have to have some sort of real science in there, speculative or otherwise. And I found a while ago that was just not something that I felt that I could particularly do well. I just think it's much, I think like Jeff said, I think it's hard to do.
Well, the other side of it too is the fact that, I mean, when people say that science fiction and fantasy are so different, I mean, on the other hand, there's a place when you go down through the story where it's just bullshit. You know, you get to that point eventually in a science fiction story, no matter how scientific it is, just like fantasy, there's a large element of bullshit there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're making it up. And so they're not that far apart, but, you know.
Well, except I think with science fiction, you're held to a higher standard because at a certain point they want to think that this would work. That you're,
right,
that
it checks you out.
Might make it up, but it's theoretically, this could actually be possible. Whereas with fantasy, I don't think anybody to really hold you to making, you know, the great god Pan here in your bedroom.
I think science fiction readers are less forgiving in that sense. They're like those jazz fans I talked about. You know, they've science fiction readers tend to have read a lot of science fiction, and they're going to be comparing you to everybody who did a similar theme earlier. And they, and you're right. I mean, Jeff, you're absolutely right. There's a point in almost any science fiction story that's pure hand-waving. And the game that some writers play is, if I know enough more about this stuff than they do, I can get away with it.
Yeah, historical writing is like that, too, in a way. You don't really know. One of the things I discovered about it is I think you don't really, you can't put in, you know, you don't really want to put in all of these touchstones of the time because they clutter the story up. But if you have a few details that you can place judiciously, and the big thing is the writing style, you know, of the time. But if you just place the few things judiciously, it's more effective in a way than, you know, being a scholar on the particular subject. And the book that I think about, and I, you know, is The Alienist by Caleb Carr. I mean, there's so many touchstones in that I thought it was too crowded with stuff, you know, like specifics about that time period. And it kind of bogged the story down for me in some respects. Although I thought it was an interesting book otherwise, you know.
It's like when you're watching a movie that pays so much attention to historical detail, but the story gets lost, you know.
Yeah.
People are there, and they're, you know, everybody's smoking the brand of cigarette, and they're driving the car, and this, that, and the other, but it everything else sort of gets lost.
Yeah.
And I've seen that happen way too often. I started reading a novel, which... in the first 50 pages, it's Victorian London, and of course it has Victorian. And in the first 50 pages, I made these notes. We get introduced to Tom Thumb, Quasimodo, Victor Frankenstein, Mr. Hyde, E.T.A. Hoffman, Jack the Ripper. It's like, okay, anything I could find in 19th century Europe is going to be here. And after a while, you're thinking, is there a story here, or is this just the tour guide?
Yeah. You know who's really good at it is where I came to this realization was from reading Andy Duncan's stories.
Oh yeah,
because he wrote a number of historical. Well, he still does at times, you know. But he wrote these historical stories, and I would read them, and then I started to notice like how often he's giving me like you know some particle of the real history there, and it's not that often, but the way he uses them. The manner in which he places them in the story makes it seem authentic. You know what I mean? Plus, always a great story going along with it.
Yeah.
One of the two historical writers, one who we don't normally think of as one, I guess, that I think handled this exactly right are Cecilia Holland and Gene Wolfe in the Soldier of the Mist novels. And I've talked to both of them, and they both see writing that kind of historical fiction as being more akin to writing fantasy, in that they put you in a world, and they don't give you any lectures about the world at all. You're right. Inside the world view of those people, and you have to figure it out, just like you have to figure out what the rules of this world are in a fantasy novel. And when you're dealing with characters who believe in the supernatural, of course the supernatural is going to show up in the story.
Right.
Daphne du Maurier does that, somebody who's a genre writer, but from a different genre. I've been kind of on a du Maurier kick recently, and I read for the first time My Cousin Rachel and Jamaica Inn, which are both historical novels, you know.
Yeah.
They're set in the, I guess, one in the late 18th century and the other in the 19th century. And she just does this beautiful job. You never have any doubt in your mind but that you're in a different century. But she does it so subtly that you're just completely immersed in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're in a fairly remote place. You're in this remote part of Cornwall. But she does this beautiful job of describing not just the landscape, but the way people are set in it. And there's a beautiful set piece in Jamaica Inn where the central character, the narrator, goes to a town fair on Christmas Eve in some tiny little town out in, you know, this remote part of Cornwall. And it's one of the best pieces of historical writing I've ever encountered. And I've never read it before. I've never seen it mentioned anywhere as being this set piece, but it's wonderful. It's beautifully done. And, you know, for my money, probably better than a lot of the stuff that you'd find in, you know, George Eliot.
Hey, did you read Don't Look Now while you were reading her stuff?
Yeah, I have read that.
I wanted to ask you, I never read it, but is it as creepy as the movie? The movie's great.
Yeah, the movie's great. It has a different feel. I read that a long time ago. I'm going to reread that one. Yeah, it's great. It's fantastic. All of her stuff is great. Yeah. Some of it feels a little bit dated, but my cousin Rachel, which I, you know, I don't know if you guys have read it. I had not read it.
And that's
probably one of the most brilliant, you know, first person narrators. You know, talk about an unreliable narrator. It's so brilliantly done. And she's somebody who, you know, who was, I don't know what her, you know, standing is now in literature, but, you know, she was always kind of dismissed as being a woman's writer, a genre writer, a gothic writer. But she's brilliant. She just, you know, the kind of stuff she does, if she was around today, well, she was a bestseller when she was writing then. But anyway, I think that she is somebody who really, whose standing should be raised somewhat in the world of letters. I'm sorry?
One of her very last novels, I think, was The House on the Strand, which... it's a time travel story. I mean, it's you could even rationalize it as a science fiction story.
That's one I haven't read.
I haven't read it in years, but I remember when it came out thinking, here's somebody who, you know, mostly because, I guess, of Hitchcock and a little bit because of that Nicholas Rogue movie, had probably a bigger reputation in the movies in the last 50 years than in literature.
Yeah.
You had Rebecca, you had The Birds, you had obviously Don't Look Now, and yet the novels themselves, I don't even know if they're still in print.
Well, yeah. I think New York Review of Books put out a collection of her stuff not too long ago.
Good.
You sold me on her, Liz. I'm going to check her out.
Yeah, check out My Cousin Rachel, because it's you have to kind of get into it, because at the beginning it seems just this very kind of, you know, it does seem like gothic women's fiction, but it's much, much stranger than that. She was a very, she was a strange writer in a good way.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in the past there that needs to be looked at again. Yeah.
That's one of the things we talk about at the ReaderCon every year when they have a deceased guest of honor, or they try to have the Cord Wiener Smith Award for somebody. But there's this vast, I mean, an old science fiction writers and old fantasy genre writers get resurrected all the time by fans and amateur presses. But people like Du Maurier, or people like another writer I grew up loving, was Robert Nathan, who probably is the biggest single influence on Peter Beagle of any other writer.
Yeah, Beagle wrote an introduction to one of his books, right? Was it for Tachyon? It was Jenny or something? Or
Portrait of Jenny.
Yeah. There's a book from that time period I got a copy of from Tosserus. Is that the name of the press in the UK, I think? I forget the name of the book, but it's about these two guys who make up when they're on vacation, this woman in their minds, and they talk about her, and, you know, as a goof, and then it goes the next step, and they write her a letter, you know, and they get back to where they live, and they get a letter from this woman. She's coming to visit them, and she comes to visit them. And it gets really, I mean, it's a really sweet story, but it's real creepy, too, in a lot of ways, you know? I forget the name of it now.
This is an older writer?
Like, yeah. I can't remember that. I can't remember it. I might have it here somewhere. No, I can't remember. Sorry about that. That was like kind of a non sequitur.
But he's got us all curious now.
I know, yeah, that's not non sequitur, that's just a tease.
that's what it is.
I can't remember the name of it.
But yeah, there's so many writers who wrote fascinating stuff before, you know, all the quote-unquote genre walls went up, or who just, you know, were writing outside that altogether.
Well, I mean, I had the experience yesterday, I watched Night of the Hunter on, you know, and...
Oh, yeah.
that book, I mean, that movie now, you know, looking at it now, it's just so wild in a lot of ways. I mean, there's kind of like fairy tale, dreamlike imagery and the threat involved in it and everything. It's as compelling as anything contemporary that I've seen in the last, couple of months, at least as far as movies go. I mean, most of the stuff that they have on, I see a lot of stuff on TV, you know, on the cable channels. It's just all the same. I watched some movie the other night with Jason Statham. Is that his name? The Mechanic? I mean, it's the same fucking movie he's made, you know, six different times. But then you see something like Night of the Hunter, and you're like, oh, my God, this is really what film could be. I'm sure that there's stuff back there that if, you know, you delve into it, you're going to discover some of these gems like Du Maurier or somebody like that.
Well, that was almost like an expressionist film, but that kind of that, Charles Laughton, that was the only film he ever directed because it was such a colossal flop. It just
completely
tanked. Nobody knew what to make of it.
Yeah, he said, "I'll never make another movie," and he didn't.
He didn't.
Ouch.
There's a lesson there for us.
But there are some pure, I mean, talk about dreamlike images. I remember. The minute you mention that, I get vivid images coming to mind of Robert Mitchum riding along the... Dreaming of the everlasting water. Or Shelley Winters underwater with...
Underwater.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the scenes that really struck me, where the guy sees her in the boat, where he looks down and sees her.
Yeah.
Amazing. And Mitchum is so whack in that movie, like screaming and crying and, you know, singing and everything.
He runs up the steps after the kids like Frankenstein with his arms out in front of him.
That's
weird.
he gets shot and he starts jumping around and yelping like a dog.
Oh,
I know, but I mean now say that movie as a story appeared in like a genre magazine. I mean, I would call that a horror flick. I mean, you could call it a horror story, but would it be the kind of thing that people would complain about because there was no fantastic element in it or, you know, whatever? But it seems a fantasy, too, in a lot of ways.
Well, it was a David Scrubb novel, and as I recall, when it was published in paperback, it was marketed kind of as a horror novel in the way that some of Robert Bloch's non-supernatural stories were. So it was a very creepy novel. I remember reading it a long time ago. Huh. But it wasn't nearly as stylized as the movie.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. We've been talking for a little over an hour, so that's usually a fairly good place to wind up.
Excuse me, Kara. This is a podcast, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks.
I hate to bring reality crashing back in on a perfectly good roundtable. But I did want to give everyone an opportunity to go through. The traditional closing is to give everyone a chance to talk about what they might be working on right now or what they might have out right now. So I'll start with Liz.
Well, I just found out on Friday I got a contract to do another YA novel that I'll be doing with Viking. Haven't written it yet, called Wilding Hall. And it's actually, it is a riff on Daphne Du Maurier. It's kind of loosely inspired by Rebecca, but set at a theatrical camp for teenagers.
Cool.
So it's kind of a psychological thriller, you know, suspense novel, but sort of set in the world of artsy young people.
Neat. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, I was excited. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to write it. And I love Du Maurier, so it's, you know, to be able to kind of, do sort of a riff on some of her work, I think will be fun.
Cool. And Jeff?
I'm finishing up a story for this collection that's coming out next year. It's called Crackpot Palace, and it's got... It's either going to have 19 or 20 stories in it, and that's coming out next year. And then I have stories coming out in anthologies, the Lamb's Head Curiosities, Jeff and Ann Vandermeer, Ellen Datlow's Naked City, supernatural noir. I think that's Ellen and Terry Windling, and a number of different stories are coming out in the next couple of months.
Very cool. And Gary, I think this has been acting as another good, 40-odd minutes of advertising for evaporating genres.
Well, here's the thing I just learned about evaporating genres, which thrilled me no end. It's available both for Kindle and Nook.
Oh.
And they're really cheap. I mean, if you grow up writing academic books, and the idea of actually having something that somebody can afford to buy,
yeah,
just absolutely thrills me. It's like $9.99 on Nook, I think, or something like that.
That's kind of amazing.
Well, the other thing is with evaporating genres, it's a very readable book too. I don't read a lot of literary criticism, you know what I mean? But it's a very readable book, which I appreciated.
Well, thank you. That's coming from somebody who knows how to write. So I
Excellent. Well, again, thank you all very much for your time, and hopefully we'll catch you back on the Locust Roundtable podcast another time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you all.
Thanks, Carrie.